Buildings have been routinely ignored by many, but buildings, both commercial and residential, represent in every nation a far larger source of global warming pollution than cars and trucks.
The growing need for air conditioning is not necessarily due to climate change, but due to bad design. So says Fergus Nicol, the professor of environmental architecture at Oxford Brookes University.
We're building a paradigm that not only is not sustainable, but it's killing the planet too. The estate agents get paid according to how big and shiny a building is. They get higher rents for big shiny buildings. If it's air conditioned, they get double the lease rent. The whole system is designed to protect business as usual.
And more people are going to be coming. It's going to get bigger and bigger, and we're going to have to accommodate more people, and let's think along those lines.
Building Madness with Radio EcoShock. Another evening downtown, another forum. This one is called Our Transportation Future. Usual suspects are on the stage, three professors and a city engineer. I'm feeling smugness about our city. It's invading the room. We have reached our goals for cars downtown, they say, years early. The new buzzword eco-density makes all the glass-walled condos sound so green. The local joke is the city has a new symbolic bird, the crane. The mayor is pro-development. The premier or governor is a friend of developers. Everybody seems to feed on campaign donations from building bigger and bigger cities. Pedestrians are still run down regularly in this model city. A two-bedroom condo downtown sells for $500,000. Glossy full-page advertisements show the new suave bourgeois couple luxuriating in their tiny mansions with granite countertops piled 60 stories high. It's all set up like a magnet for the rich. Working-class people can't afford anything in this planner's dream. Down below, not shown on the slides tonight, a growing swarm of homeless people dig through the dumpsters for pop cans. I'll bet half the population is on drugs, legal or illegal, just to kill the pain, the gnawing sense of disconnection. Everyone is part of the growth agenda, though. They either work for the developers, or they struggle to clean up that mess. The city tries to add enough bushes and strips of grass, like billboards, to remind the prisoners of a bygone nature. Lost in the memory of real hills, with real season, something in me snaps. I interrupt the dream with a rude question.
Well, I think it's appropriate. My name is Alex. I'm from CFRO Radio. I think it's appropriate that we end the evening with a heresy because, you know, minds have to think to be challenged. Now, what I've heard here is all the pro-growth argument, and I believe, you know, perhaps our council is founded on that. But there are people who would like to see Vancouver hit a sort of steady state. You know, they're kind of happy with this small city, big city that we've got. And maybe don't want to see 1,000-story towers going up and total density. So that's one thing to think about is there a voice for the steady state version as opposed to total growth version of where we're going to go? And the other thought I'd just like to add is, you know, we have to plan for everything, and often the future is not what we expect. I can see several reasons why Vancouver City in particular and the whole area may begin to depopulate. And you could go into earthquakes, you could go into endemic diseases, you could go into food shortages where people actually need land around them to grow a little bit of food to get by. And we don't seem to be planning for those scenarios. We're just building this mega hive, and I'm not sure that it's really going to work in the future. So I just leave you with that thought.
The basic answer is this. All over the world, humans are leaving villages and fields to found humongous cities. It is the greatest migration of all time happening now. Where a movie once promised, if you build it, they will come, reality now shouts, build it or not, they are coming. Humans flock to shanty towns, to suburbs, to luxury townhomes built into the brand name hotels, even the most enlightened planners. Can only hope to steer the tide into something quasi-natural. Urban strategists become, well, psychologists, trying to limit the spread of a new post-natural stress disorder syndrome. This is Alex Smith, and you are listening to Radio EcoShock. In this program, we'll hear at least a half dozen perspectives on the city and alleged green development. Is global city building just a Ponzi scheme, an urban craze, another unsupportable bubble? Why does deep green critic Derek Jensen claim cities always lead to fascism over the land?
I've burned my tomorrow, and I stand inside today, at the edge of the future, and my dreams all fade away.
Background, high oil prices and limited supply are forcing the Uber realtors to pause for a minute. Some academic and professional voices, formerly shunned by the moneymakers, are returning from exile. As we will hear, architects like Sir Norman Foster can reclaim their green beliefs. 60s idea man Buckminster Fuller is being recalled. We'll hear a lot of voices in this show. You can download their complete speeches from our website at ecoshock.org. To make that easy, find all the links from this program in the EcoShock blog at ecoshock.org/podcast. The links will be right at the top of the entry for June 5th, 2008. One radical city planner envisions replacing architecture with ecotecture. Richard Register is lately being dragged around the world as people try to comprehend the new city. Let's listen now as Richard Register describes the dream on KCSB Radio in Santa Barbara, California.
Richard, if you could give our listeners, and just in case you just tuned in, this is Jill Cloutier for Sustainable World, and I'm joined from Oakland, California, Richard Register, one of the world's great theorists and authors in ecological city design and planning. Now, Richard, when I was reading part of your book, it seems like you're really advocating for not just making these small changes that support our dysfunctional, destructive system, but a total redesign. What can you tell our listeners, what would an eco-city look like? And you've gone into that a bit, but maybe give us a bit of an overview on that.
Well, first of all, imagine that most areas, even in Santa Barbara, you have several distinct communities within the area that's developed, and you have low-density housing that rolls out over the hills and down and up the coast and so on. Same thing writ large exists in the metropolitan areas like I am in and that are all over the country and spreading all over the world right now, by the way. So imagine a metropolitan area and then finding the real neighborhood centers within that and the city center itself, the downtown, and the major district centers, which are like the larger neighborhood centers. Just imagine three kind of centers, sort of a smallish neighborhood center, a district center, and the downtown. Well, imagine those actually growing more intensely. The buildings get taller, but around them, creeks start opening up. Community gardens get bigger. Coastlines, you withdraw a little bit from coastlines and ridgelines, so you get more beautiful views here and there. While the city is kind of going up, and the neighborhood center then becomes a village over time, and the district center becomes a small town or a small city. The downtown becomes a much more vital downtown, a larger downtown, and a small city in its own right. And so you have people, residential people, moving into the business center. You have some businesses opening up in the residential areas a little farther away that might be a neighborhood center, but they all take up much less land than they used to. Well, now in the United States, cities take up three or four times the land area for the number of people than they do in Europe anyway, you know. So, and they run on about the same amount of energy. So there's something very, very significant in that. And that is that if you have more diversity close together, you can have more compactness, take up less land, and use much, much less energy. So it's a good idea. Now, to really visualize this, you have to get into the details somewhat. If you have a taller building, a lot of people say, oh, I don't like taller buildings. They're sort of intimidating. They have these big cliffs all around them. Their edges drop, you know. Well, you can terrace these buildings. You can have them linked by bridges. You can have rooftop gardens and terrace gardens up there. You can have cafes and restaurants and little shops with great views over the region that you're in. it's not for no reason that people pay a whole lot more money when they get a penthouse, because they got beautiful views and it's a fun place to be. It's got fresh air and breezes and so on. So if you can imagine the city changing architecturally like that, while the waterways are coming back in, the community gardens are getting bigger and so on, then you have some kind of an idea of this transition towards an eco-city.
So it sounds like it's more of an integration of nature within the city than having this separate boundary between where we live in the city and this urban concrete-filled place, and then we drive 40 miles to go hiking.
Well, the thing is that the city that we have now has no real definite boundary. It sort of frays out on the edges all over the place, and you go farther and farther out, and there are less and less houses usually. It's kind of the way it works. So it doesn't really have a very distinct boundary. But when you get to the more compact city, you actually do have a more distinct boundary, but a much smaller footprint. But then you just pop through that boundary by walking over to where the creek is, or over to where your larger community gardens and parks and recreational areas are. So it's interesting because you don't have nature right inside your buildings, unless you want to have a little vermiculture thing in your basement to decompose organic waste or something. That's fine. But you do have this distinct thing of a finer-grained social architecture and literal architecture right there next to the natural environment.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just a different design.
You're tuned to KCSB, as you just heard, 91.9 FM in Santa Barbara and streaming worldwide at www.kcsb.org. And I'm Jill Cloutier for Sustainable World.
Richard Register's latest book is Eco-Cities, Building Cities in Balance with Nature. His blog is ecocityviews.blogspot.com. Back home from the Transportation Forum, I listen again. Actually, the speakers are the wrong target for my frustration and questions. They are friendly voices. Simon Fraser University Professor Anthony Pearl is one to learn about. I recorded the launch of his book with Richard Gilbert called Transport Revolutions. You can download that from the transportation page of our website at ecoshock.org. At the Transportation Forum, well, just as General Motors and Ford announced the shutdowns of their infernal assembly plants, making climate-killing trucks and SUVs.
Fill it up there, will ya, Father Phil? My Hummer there's on empty.
Anthony Pearl describes a different time when car production stopped almost overnight in the United States.
Here's a man you've probably never heard of, and Donald Nelson, who was the chairman of the War Production Board. The U.S. entered World War II late compared to Canada and many other countries. Remember, December 7th was the key day for them in 1941. January 16th, 1942, this War Production Board is created to basically manage an economic transition in a very concentrated, compressed time period. The first thing they decided to do was to cancel civilian car production. Notice the timeline. January 16th, they're created. February 10th, they issue the first order. It's convenient statistically that the war began basically after a full production year was done in 1941. The U.S. produced 3.8 million cars in 1941. By 1943, there were 143 civilian cars produced in the United States. And at least until some of the latest SUVs that Ford has put out, those were the biggest, heaviest vehicles they ever made during that period, and the toughest ones, I'm sure, still along the way. The point is that they were able to make that transition, and it took, but they didn't initiate it. That's the key to remember, that when pointed in the right direction and given a nice push from government, industry rose to the challenge in transportation. And maybe this time, instead of tanks, it could be electric trains and buses that Ford, which is, I just read today, cutting back by double-digit percentages its manufacturing capacity because of rising energy prices and reduced demand. So there's a need for leadership. These things sometimes get to a point where crises push people forward. Why did Donald Nelson make this decision? Is it because he hated cars? I doubt it. Is it because he was some sort of rabid radical? I also doubt it was because of necessity. It was because he had the rational ability to look at the American industrial and military and strategic and energy situations, all of which were connected then as they are now, and say, we've got to do something fast. Cars are the single largest, at that time, source of consumption of steel, of glass, of rubber, all of which were needed for military use at the time, the single largest consumption of gasoline as well. Gas and tire rationing came in. There was a 40% drop in vehicle kilometers in just 2 years, not 25, but 2 years. And public transportation and rail transportation use doubled, more than doubled during that time.
During the Second World War, the government and the people realized there was no time or materials to waste on large fancy cars. They stopped making personal vehicles to fight Hitler's mad dream of power. This time around, the decider-in-chief was accommodating toward the coming climate holocaust. Bush was the NASCAR president. One of the Ford family, William Clay Ford Jr., has objected to the giant gas guzzlers being made by his own company. Perhaps he did not want the family name to be remembered as the ones who stopped the rain, the ones who brought the killer storms, the ones who melted the Arctic. But the Ford company continued to churn out oil-hungry trucks and SUVs like the Expedition. General Motors did not act to save the planet or even to limit the flow of American jobs and money going overseas. Faced with scientific evidence of the greatest tragedy to threaten all life on the planet, a threat making Hitler look like a pipsqueak, General Motors responded bravely with the Hummer. On June 3rd, as customers deserted company gas guzzlers, GM announced it will close 4 truck plants. GM may sell the Hummer brand or end production.
All right, bravo. One more car destroyed.
Ah, the Hummer, the end of a brazen symbol of climate-hating bravado, the car that says, I just don't care about our children's future. Make your own bumper stickers, people, and slap them on those gas-guzzling trucks and tanks that are out there on the roads. Well, the sticker should say, I am killing the world. GM reconsiders fuel efficiency, just 5 or 10 years too late, to save either the company's reputation or the planet. Apparently, the greedy only react when their own clothes are on fire.
Captain's log, emergency report. We are fast being sucked into the hideous vortex of a black hole.
Professor Pearl does have one example of a way out. While General Motors famously killed their own working electric car, Israel is working on a new transportation model.
Anyways, my question is directed at Dr. Pearl. It's about the situation that's happening right now in Israel with Israel and Nissan. I don't know if you're familiar with it at all. Nissan
Project
and
Better Place.
The other third party.
Renault.
Right. Do you see that as a transportation revolution, or is it just sort of another stopgap thing like hydrogen-powered cars?
Well, just to fill in the gaps, there is a Silicon Valley billionaire who convinced the Israeli government that they should their next Google equivalent would be to lead the world in electric car uptake and applications. And the organization model of this would be that people wouldn't own the cars. They would just sign contracts and pay by the kilometer and the hour for using them. But you'd have your own car. It's just sort of like a lease arrangement. And the Israeli government's put tax breaks and other sort of regulatory incentives in place for this. And the claim is that Renault and Nissan are going to roll out their electric vehicles there within the next 2 to 5 years because there's a guaranteed market for it. And Israel will do its best, since it doesn't have a lot of oil of its own, to make sure that it's renewable generation of electricity, or maybe nuclear, given their proclivities, that might be part of it as well. What will it mean in the long run? It will probably accelerate the deployment of electric cars, and it may test the model for sort of replacing the old gas guzzlers that people will feel less risk in buying a $30,000, $40,000 equivalent vehicle if they can, you know, sort of pay, you know, $200 a month or whatever it is plus a kilometer charge for this. And if it breaks, they can give it back. Or if it becomes obsolete, it's not a, you know, a sunk cost in the way that, you know, another type of experimental vehicle might be. So they're trying to be a catalyst. The people involved are applying sort of new thinking from the information age to the transportation issues, which, again, breaks from the idea that in the past, I mean, if this would have been done under the old model, the one of the last 30 years, it would be, let's find some, you know, sort of guinea pig population, someone else who either has never had cars before or is too poor to have cars, and give them this, you know, sort of experiment and see if they survive. And the difference in Israel is they're trying to make this a mainstream approach that that people would use as a first choice. So it does have some promise. What the outcome, there's going to be a lot of uncertainty. I mean, transport revolutions have lots of uncertainty in them. And if anyone tells you they know exactly, you know, how many bikes or cars or electric buses are going to be there in 2030 or 2025, it's unrealistic, I think.
You are tuned to speeches from the forum Our Transportation Future, May 22, 2008. It was part of the Shifting Gears series of public discussions on Greater Vancouver's transportation options. Regular EcoShock listeners know that a whole crowd of people like Richard Heinberg, Julian Darley, and James Howard Kunstler have been predicting an end to suburbia. As the era of cheap oil winds down, you can find Kunstler's first speech as a visiting scholar in the Radio EcoShock shows for February of 2008 on our website. Likely, you can guess how far-flung suburbs with long commutes feed greenhouse gases relentlessly into the sky. But did you know they also make people fat? At the same forum, Vancouver professor Lawrence Frank, known to all as Larry, explained both the global warming and the new data on compact cities versus suburban obesity. Here is just a few short minutes from that talk, a quick shot, taken from fast-moving slides and years of published papers.
The design of communities is affecting or related with how much we as individuals are growing in terms of our own waistline. We are actually rapidly becoming an obesogenic society. The statistics are alarming. And with that comes significant healthcare costs. Land use decisions and transportation investments collectively form a built environment that do relate with or affect, I would argue, affect causally, although we haven't proved it yet, we will, that activity patterns and how we engage in our health. So basically how active we are through transportation, and that relates, as it seems to, consistently in now over 37 different studies with people's body weight and physical activity and body weight. But a report we recently did for the Vancouver Foundation shows, for example, urban core, inner suburb, outer suburb, and rural suburban, and you can see the percent that are obese. And as you move from the urban to the edge, you see it go from 35% to 52%, up to 61 or 62%. So the rate of obesity increases steadily as you move from the center to the edge of the region. There's a lot of self-selection going on here, I'll tell you that. It's not just the neighborhood or the environment. People choose neighborhoods based on their preferences. But there's clearly a pattern going on here. And obesity is a really important predictor for healthcare problems or chronic disease or type 2 diabetes. It's pretty serious. In fact, the statistics are alarming. If you put some dollars behind it, it gets a lot of eyebrows raised. Because in general, the distances to other destinations is really going to matter a lot. It's going to override, so you're not going to get a win-win between greenhouse gas emissions reduction with long commutes and physical activity benefits. In other words, where really matters. So we're kind of kidding ourselves as we start to punch out large subdivisions in rural areas and then throw in recreational amenities and say, well, it's going to promote physical activity and reduce automobile dependence and call it smart growth and make it pretty. That's really not going to reduce people's use of the car. It's just not going to happen. It's not rational. You still have to drive a 2-ton or whatever 1-ton piece of metal to get a loaf of bread. Climate change follows, or greenhouse gas emissions, urban form, pretty clearly based on vehicle miles traveled. You can see CO2 kilograms per day per person as density increases in Seattle, for example, steady decline, no surprise there, distances are shorter. Another relationship would be intersections per acre, or the connectivity of the street network, meaning how directly can you move from point A to B, as I showed in a graph previously. And you can see a steady decline, again, in kilograms of CO2 as connectivity increases. You can look and see number of retail parcels or how many destinations near where you live are you able to get to, and how does that relate with how much greenhouse gas emissions you create. Steady decline, but a bit of a threshold condition may occur at about 10 or 20 parcels of retail use, meaning if you have enough stuff near you, you're going to walk to it. So there's a bit of a critical mass possible condition there. I'll just mention what this is because it's a lot of information, but basically we've been looking at what sort of a reduction could we actually get if we had urban forum policies that were more aggressive in terms of creating more walkable places. Projected out into the future in Seattle, we could see about a 24% reduction in vehicle miles traveled, which predicts about 93% or vehicle kilometers traveled of CO2 emissions. So it's pretty much a straight one-on-one shot, and you can see that's from a doubling of average connect of these urban forum measures. So residential density, one we all understand, let's just take that. If we double it from 3.6 to about 7.3, we see a reduction, you know, you can see the average across the region. So it sounds horrific, like doubling walkability or all these urban forum measures, but in fact, we're not a very, I mean, a lot of this region's fairly low density, fairly unwalkable. There's a lot of room for increasing the compactness through transit-oriented development. So it just shows the benefits of increasing the walkability of areas. It's intuitive, it might be obvious, but it actually is important to quantify if we want to make it a strategy for greenhouse gas emissions reduction. Is that we've run a variety of scenarios with the Center for Clean Air Policy tied through with the Brookings Institution in the U.S., on a different technological strategies to reduce greenhouse gas emissions by 80% by 2050. And you can see basically the numbers here. To hit the 80% target, what has to happen is in Seattle, the average person drives 27 miles per day. It looks like the average person in Seattle will be able to drive about 9 or a third as many vehicle miles of travel in the year 2050, about a third as being projected today or is happening today. In fact, what's happening right now, and you can't see this, but vehicle miles of travel are increasing per capita and plus population growth. So we're completely going in the wrong direction in most regions, and in fact, we're heading in the wrong direction fast.
The speeches of Larry Frank and Anthony Pearl are available from our website on the transportation page. Here in Vancouver, Mayor Sam Sullivan has a new word for cramming people in as tightly as possible. In June 2006, Sullivan, flanked by some environmentalists and academics, launched a city planning approach called ecodensity. Then this business mayor patented that term in his own name. Ecodensity aims to protect the local and global environment by creating tight, high population areas. With homes, shops, and work within walking or biking distance, car travel and emissions could be reduced. Allegedly, the building spree of taller buildings with smaller spaces will make housing more affordable, although there is no sign of that yet in this city. Sullivan is pushing this pro-development eco-density idea as a way to fight climate change. Predictably, residents of many neighborhoods have created a coalition against eco-density and for livability. They want a charter of neighborhood rights to fight off mass rezoning for developers and to protect existing neighborhoods. Should all cities look like Manhattan? Will that save the climate? I know some people do enjoy living downtown without their car. Is that what humans need? Coming up, I want to introduce another architect. Our featured speaker for next week's show, Dr. Guido Wimmers, brings some of the best low-energy building solutions straight from Germany and Austria. But first, let's join Sir Norman Foster as he speaks to the Digital Life Design Conference in Munich, January 2007. This is one of the grand old men of building with natural light to illuminate not just the insides of buildings, but people's spirits. I have recorded about 10 minutes from that speech, and I urge you to go to TED, Technology, Entertainment, and Design, at TED.com, to view the whole video for free. Then you will see the striking beauty of the buildings created or led by Norman Foster. Again, find that link in my blog at ecoshock.org/podcast.
As an architect, you design for the present, with an awareness of the past, for a future which is essentially unknown. The Green Agenda is probably the most important agenda and issue of the day, and I'd like to share some experience. Over the last 40 years, we celebrate our 40th anniversary this year. And to explore and to touch on some observations about the nature of sustainability, how far you can anticipate, what follows from it, what are the threats, what are the possibilities, the challenges, the opportunities. I think that I've said in the past, many, many years ago, before anybody even invented the concept of a green agenda, that it wasn't about fashion, it was about survival.
We'll be right back in 30 seconds with more of Sir Norman Foster on Green Building. We return to Sir Norman Foster on Green Building.
But what I never said, and what I'm really going to make the point, is that really, green is cool. I mean, all the projects which have in some way been inspired by that agenda are about a celebratory lifestyle, in a way celebrating the places and the spaces which determine the quality of life. I rarely actually quote anything, so I'm going to try and find a piece of paper if I can, which somebody at the end of last year ventured the thought about what for that individual, as a kind of important observer, analyst, writer, a guy called Thomas Friedman, who wrote in the Herald Tribune about 2006, he said, I think the most important thing to happen in 2006 was that living and thinking green hit Main Street. We reached a tipping point this year where living, acting, designing, investing and manufacturing green came to be understood by a critical mass of citizens, entrepreneurs and officials as the most patriotic, capitalistic, geopolitical and competitive thing they could do. Hence my motto, green is the new red, white, and blue. And I ask myself, in a way, looking back, when did that kind of awareness of the planet and its fragility first appear? And I think it was July the 20th, 1969, when, for the first time, man could look back at planet Earth. And in a way, it was Buckminster Fuller who coined that phrase. And before the kind of collapse of the communist system, I was privileged to meet a lot of cosmonauts in Space City and other places in Russia. And interestingly, as I think back, they were the first true environmentalists. They were filled with a kind of pioneering passion, fired about the problems of the Aral Sea. And at that period, it was, in a way, a number of things were happening. Buckminster Fuller was the kind of green guru, again, a word that had not been coined. He was a design scientist, if you like, a poet, but he foresaw all the things that are happening now. And it's another subject, it's another conversation. You can go back to his writings. It's quite extraordinary. So the problems of sustainability cannot be separated from the nature of the cities of which the buildings are a part. For example, if you take and you make a comparison between a recent kind of city, what I'll call simplistically a North American city, and Detroit is not a bad example, it is very car dependent. The city goes out in annular rings, consuming more and more green space and more roads and more energy in the transport of people between the city center, which again the city centre, as it becomes deprived of the living and just becomes commercial, again becomes dead. If you compare Detroit with a city of a northern European example, and Munich is not a bad example of that, with the greater dependence on walking and cycling, then a city which is really only twice as dense is only using one-tenth of the energy. In other words, you take these comparable examples, and the energy leap is enormous. So basically, if you wanted to generalize, you can demonstrate that as the density increases along the bottom there, that the energy consumed reduces dramatically. Of course, you can't separate this out from issues like social diversity, mass transit, the ability to be able to walk a convenient distance, the quality of civic spaces. But again, you can see Detroit in yellow at the top. Extraordinary consumption down below Copenhagen. And Copenhagen, although it's a dense city, is not dense compared with the really dense cities. And in the year 2000, a rather interesting thing happened. You had for the first time mega cities, 5 million or more, which were occurring in the developing world. And now out of typically 46 cities, 33 of those mega cities are in the developing world. So you have to ask yourself the environmental impact of, for example, China or India. If you take China and you just take Beijing, you can see on that traffic system and the pollution associated with the consumption of energy as the cars expand at the price of the bicycles. In other words, if you put onto the roads, as it's currently happening, 1,000 new cars every day, statistically, it's the biggest booming auto market in the world. And the 500 million bicycles serving 1.3 billion people are reducing. And that urbanization is extraordinary accelerated pace. So if we think of the transition in our society of the movement from the land to the cities, which took 200 years, then that same process is happening in 20 years. In other words, it is accelerating by a factor of 10. We take that and you expand that further into the Chinese society. And what is interesting is that that produces, in a way, perhaps the ultimate mega building. It is physically the largest project on the planet at the moment. 50,000 people working 24 hours, 7 days. Larger by 17% than every terminal put together at Heathrow, built plus the new unbuilt Terminal 5. And the challenge here is a building that will be green, that is compact despite its size, and is about the human experience of travel, is about friendly, is coming back to that starting point, is very, very much about the lifestyle. And perhaps these, in the end, as celebratory spaces, as Hubert was talking over lunch, as we sort of engaged in conversation, talked about this, talked about cities, Hubert was saying, absolutely correct, these are the new cathedrals. And in a way, one aspect of this conversation was triggered on New Year's Eve, when I was talking about the Olympic agenda in China in terms of its green ambitions and aspirations. And I was voicing the thought that it just crossed my mind that New Year's Eve, a sort of symbolic turning point as we move from 2006 to 2007, that maybe, you know, the future was, you know, the most powerful, innovative sort of nation, the way in which somebody like Kennedy inspirationally could say, we put a man on the moon. You know, who is going to say that we crack this thing of the dependence on fossil fuels, with all the being held to ransom by rogue regimes and so on? And that's a concerted platform. It's more than one device. You know, it's renewable. And I voiced the thought that maybe at the turn of the year, I thought the inspiration was more likely to come from those other larger countries out there, the Chinas, the Indians, the Asian Pacific Tigers. Thank you very much.
Do you notice something ajar in Foster's ending, though? While he championed the new green architecture, Foster ends with the grand scheme, projected as the world's largest building, now developing in China. And what is it? A gargantuan airport, hangars for all the oil-fueled planes that will seed the sky with our destruction. Design for a future nightmare. An article in The Guardian newspaper, May 31, 2008, says that greenwash about supposedly eco-friendly buildings is blocking real progress. A report by the Commission for Architecture and the Built Environment in the UK finds green gadgets are blocking real progress. The review of over 700 big construction projects going over the last 2 years in Britain found that less than 10 actually focused on sustainability. The CABE report names Sir Norman Foster's projects as part of the problem. Matt Bell told The Guardian, quote, "There are some architects and developers who really get climate change, but most don't or choose not to. As a result, we get a lot of greenwash, such as green gadgets and microtechnology stuck onto buildings rather than a proper approach to sustainable design," end quote. Derek Jensen, author of Endgame, says this twist is inevitable. Monster cities are never environmentally friendly. They only survive by dominating nature and the surrounding countryside. Cities are by definition, he says, never self-sustaining. The citizens must drain as much as they can from the countryside around them and from the rest of the world, with big shipping lines and lots of oil costs. When big cities are hungry, they fill their needs by any means, by threats or by actual use of force. Cities need armies. They breed armies. That is a fact of history.
And so I've defined civilization as a way of life characterized by the growth of cities. And that's defensible both linguistically and historically. That's very nice, Derek, but what is a city? So a city I've defined as a collection of people living in numbers large enough to require the importation of resources. And what that means is the Talua were not civilized. They didn't live in cities. They lived in villages and camps. They lived there, as I said, for 12,000 years at least, and they didn't require the importation of resources. They ate salmon, huckleberries, elk, clams, marine mammals, salmon, and then usually through the winter months they would eat quite a bit of salmon. But they didn't require the importation of resources. And two things happen as soon as you require the importation of resources. One is that your way of living can never be sustainable. Because if you require the importation of resources, it means that you've denuded the landscape of that particular resource. As your city grows, you will denude an ever larger area of that particular resource. It can never be sustainable. And the other thing it means is that your way of life must be based on violence. Because if you require the importation of that resource, trade will never be sufficiently reliable. If the people in the next watershed over have that resource and they're not going to trade you for it, if you require it, you're going to take it. And what this means is we could all become wonderful green capitalists and this way of living would still not be sustainable. We could also become junior bodhisattvas, and the U.S. military would still have to be huge, because otherwise there's no way for them to get access to the oil that's necessary to run the economy that just happens to be under somebody else's land.
Find out more about Derek Jensen at his website, derekjensen.org. Derek is spelled D-E-R-R-I-C-K, and Jensen is J-E-N-S-E-N.
dirty town. Don't like living in a dirty town. I don't like living in a dirty town, 'cause a dirty town gets me down. I saved up and I bought some land, 'cause I can't stand living in a dirty town. Yeah, I pinch my pennies and I put them down, and I wash my hands of a dirty town. Plant my seeds in the ground, yeah, I put them down in my new brown land, 'cause you can't plant seeds in a dirty town. No, you can't plant seeds in a dirty town. I've chopped in firewood, chopped in firewood, chop, 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 just like a country boy should be chopping wood. Hot country. My killing sticks are the perfect little wood. Killing sticks. Get gone from a dirty town, get gone from a dirty town. Everybody now.
Get gone from a dirty town, get gone from a dirty town.
That was Dirty Town by the Vancouver group Mother Mother. And now we go back to James Howard Kunstler.
The conventional thought about the future of the city is that it's only going to have more people in it. And more people are going to be coming. It's going to get bigger and bigger. And we're going to have to accommodate more people. And let's think along those lines. And I think what you're really going to see is that the cities are going to contract, because they simply won't be able to operate at the scale that we've experienced and that they've achieved in the last 75 years. Any way you cut it, they're going to have to contract. And the question really is only, how is that going to occur? And how much difficulty is it going to entail? And I think that, my own version of it, which most people don't believe, they just don't believe it. And, maybe their idea is more valid than mine. I really don't know. But my belief is that we're going to see a very stark reversal of the 200-year-long trend of people moving from the small towns and the farms to the big city. And that this is, in fact, going to reverse. Some trends, they just don't go on forever just because that's what you've experienced all of your life and your parents' life and your grandparents' life. Doesn't mean it's going to go on forever. For the life of us and our parents and our grandparents, we all had our lives during the rise of the industrial experience. And now we're seeing the industrial experience really come to a kind of an inflection point. And I think that you're going to see some of these major trends be different. I think you're going to see people having to leave the city for one reason or another. They can't get enough food. Food distribution breaks down. We only have a 3-day supply of food in most of North America, in the just-in-time supply system that we've evolved to keep the supermarket shelves full of stuff. That's how we do it. That's how it works. So there are any number of things that could make life in the cities really very difficult, very quickly, very suddenly. I think we're going to see eventually the cities are going to contract. They'll densify at their centers and in the appropriate places, that maybe the nodes around the centers and the waterfronts, and then all the stuff in the asteroid belt around is going to be really, we don't know what's going to happen. We don't know what the destiny of that stuff is. It may never be fixed. It may never retain its value. Some of it may become slums. Some of it may become salvage. Some of it may be ruins. We don't know.
That was James Howard Kunstler speaking in Vancouver, January 24, 2008. His whole two-hour presentation is available from our website.
This is Radio EcoShock. Light up your iPod or computer with tons of free green audio from our website at www.ecoshock.org. That's E-C-O, shock like an electric shock, .org.
We are, you and I, also wild animals. Something in us loathes the city, even as we love it.
There is a long history of hating cities. The Romans and the Mongols destroyed them stone by stone. Medieval people loved images of fallen cities with wandering sheep among the ruins. We blow them up in movies and in real wars. What a love-hate relationship. In his book, Nuclear Fear, atomic historian Spencer Wiart chronicles the long movement of intellectuals and traditionalists who have hoped for the end of cities. They dream of starting over, a rebirth for troubled humanity. But back here in media land, lost among the glossy ads for condos with soaker tubs and members-only gyms, is the huge climate threat posed by energy-hungry buildings. The people doing the Architecture 2030 project took another look at buildings. Adding up the math from construction, building energy use and maintenance, it turns out that buildings are responsible for almost half, 48% of all energy consumption in the United States, and almost half of all the greenhouse gas emissions. The data came from the U.S. Energy Administration. Even scarier, about 76% of all electricity generated in power plants is used in buildings. All that coal, or shudder, nuclear power gets wasted in buildings. Remember, these energy towers and McMansions are, well, they're smokestacks, an excuse to liberate fossil carbon right up into the helpless sky. Welcome to Carbon City. Part of the problem is our construction technique. Here is Guido Wimmers explaining the concept of heat bridges, the way our buildings actually draw in cold during the winter while spewing out wasted heat.
Let's take a little bit of a closer look to heat bridges. What is a heat bridge? So everybody knows what that is. That is an old-fashioned motorcycle motor cooled by air. So a little bit closer look, you see all that cooling ribs here. You want to cool down the motor. You do that with cooling ribs because they have a high heat conductivity and transport the heat from the inside to the outside. So that is maximizing heat bridges. Well, let's take a look to Vancouver architecture. And yeah, there are some similarities. So I really, please don't misquote me, and I really don't want to blame any architect, but just in terms of building physics, really just in terms of building physics, because some people got angry about me. The Vancouver high-rise architecture is pretty much the same. Because you always will find these concrete slabs going out through the envelope, so penetrating the envelope. Concrete is a really good material for heat conductivity. So what will happen? These ribs here will heat up the building in summer, and cool down the building in winter time. So exactly the opposite what you want to have. And if you combine that with steel or even worse, aluminum frames and bad windows, you have really a bad situation because you're putting pretty much the high conductivity materials in your envelope. So exactly that what you not should do.
That is Guido Wimmers from his Passive Building Workshop in Vancouver, May 24th. We're going to run it next week right here on Radio EcoShock. At a bookstore in Eugene, Oregon in May 2006, author James Howard Kunstler explains why he thinks the high-rise is doomed. With soaring oil prices, some giant tower buildings may be approaching bankruptcy, near abandonment. It just costs too much to heat and cool these old-style monsters. This is a coming real estate collapse, not yet reported. You heard it here. Some of the big city buildings may be abandoned, like the crappy subprime housing of Cleveland.
A lot of these houses which are built right now have to be renovated very soon because people will not afford it anymore to heat them, to cool them, or whatever.
Buildings have been routinely ignored by many, but buildings, both commercial and residential, represent in every nation a far larger source of global warming pollution than cars and trucks. But new architecture and design techniques are creating truly dramatic new savings and opportunities for huge reductions in energy use and, with it, reductions in global warming pollution. As an example of this potential, the American Institute of Architecture, and the National Conference of Mayors have endorsed the 2030 challenge, asking the global architecture and building community to immediately transform building design to require that all new buildings and developments be designed first to use one half of the fossil fuel energy they would typically consume with today's designs, and then to require that all new buildings be carbon neutral by 2030, using no fossil fuels to operate. After an extensive study, they have found this is completely feasible. A professor at Oberlin College has just presided over the completion of a building there that is not only zero carbon, it actually produces 30% more energy than it consumes. Some other countries have already required a standard calling for zero carbon for new buildings as they are now constructed. The rapid urbanization of the world's population is leading to the prospective development and building of more new urban structures in the next 35 years than all of the ones that have been built in all prior human history. Hard to imagine. But this startling trend represents a tremendous opportunity for really sharp reductions in global warming pollution through the use of intelligent architecture and design and stringent carbon standards.
That's a quote from the speech by Al Gore at the NSU School of Law, September the 18th, 2006, titled Solving the Climate Crisis. Tackling the problem of climate change caused by our buildings is even larger than the emissions caused by cars, trucks, and planes. Yet we never hear much about it. The green building demands, the protests against skyscrapers have not yet begun. But building protests will develop once people realize where the carbon is coming from and going to. If you care about the planet, will you end up protesting against cities themselves, the way we're building them now? We have no idea what a sustainable city would look like. We have never lived in one. Next week on Radio EcoShock, you and I will take step one. Dr. Guido Wimmers, formerly of Austria, now living in Vancouver, will lead us in an hour-long workshop on Passive House, the European technology of making super low-energy buildings. Houses that can be heated by your body in a few candles, municipal buildings that barely sip on oil in the winter and don't need air conditioning, apartment buildings that make sense, architecture already here and now that cuts energy consumption and global warming gases by 90%. Join us next week for Building Sanity, the Passive House Workshop. I am Alex Smith, inviting you to sample all our past programs plus tons of good green audio from our website at ecoshock.org. As always, I thank you for taking an hour to care so much about our world. Earlier, you heard a clip from Uncle's War Stories album. We leave you with the Beatles back in a fabulous remix. The album is called simply Love.